Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, we'll talk about that big moment yesterday during the impeachment trial of President Trump, where one of the president's defenders made a controversial claim about the extent of presidential power. But first, this afternoon at the Marshall Center on the USF Tampa campus, our next two guests, two scholars, will be discussing gender issues in Russia and Turkey. Our guests are Valerie Sperling and Lisa Sundstrom. They'll discuss their new book, Courting Gender Justice, Russia, Turkey, and the European Court of Human Rights. They'll be speaking at the Marshall Center. Their book explores the obstacles that confront Russian and Turkish citizens, activists, and lawyers who try to bring gender discrimination cases to court based on interviews with human rights and feminist activists and lawyers in Russia and Turkey. The work grounds the law in the personal experiences of individuals fighting to defend their rights. And Valerie and Lisa, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, Valerie and I are both experts on women's activism and social movements in Russia in the post-communist period, largely. And we had both written our own separate books and PhD dissertations about the women's movement in Russia, which has largely been acknowledged as being a pretty weak social movement, despite the kind of puzzle that women in Russia have always, and in the Soviet Union, have always been very strong, very high levels of employment and education, employment outside the home. And so it's always been a bit of a puzzle. Why isn't kind of feminism and women's activism stronger in Russia?
Were women equal in the old Soviet Union? Was there something written into their laws or constitution that granted equality for
men
and women?
Well, yes. In fact, the Soviet Union on paper was one of the most gender equal countries in the world. It was one of the very first to give women the franchise to vote, one of the first, and it was done very early in the Soviet period. And women were also enshrined in law. Women and men were equal in all kinds of ways. And so on paper, everything looked great. Social welfare benefits, things like parental leave benefits and support, women's pensions, those kinds of things were extremely strong. But the downside was that in practice, women were not equal in kind of private life. So it was well known that women experienced what was called the second shift, when they would come home from work and they would have pretty much 100% of all of the domestic and childcare responsibilities. And so that kind of held women back from being able to participate in a lot of public life. And public life, people were kind of forced to do things outside of their work time in the communist Soviet period. But after communism fell, that was something that hampered their ability to really be sort of publicly engaged and active outside of their work.
So what's going on today in modern Russia when it comes to women's equality?
It's not great, and that's partly why we wrote this book, is that there is an awful lot of discrimination against women that takes place, and that is something that has worsened in the post-Soviet period, because a lot of those legal obligations kind of fell apart when the Soviet Union fell. And so Valerie and I had both actually separately done a little bit of work about this court. Russian case is going to this international court called the European Court of Human Rights, which is a court that all Council of Europe states are subject to, and Russia is a Council of Europe state and has signed on to the European Convention on Human Rights.
It sounds like a court of last resort, that if you don't get what you want in your country, you go outside your country.
Exactly. So individual Russian citizens can send cases to this court, but only after they have what's called exhausted their domestic remedies. So they have to have gone through the domestic court system and done everything that they can do And if they get no satisfaction in their domestic, no remedy in their domestic system, then they can send cases to the court of the European Court of Human Rights, what we call the ECHR. And what we noticed about that is that Russians have been very prolific in sending these cases to the court. At the time we started writing the book, about 40,000 Russian cases were on the docket at this court, and Russia was the leading state of all of the countries in Europe that are members of the Council of Europe in sending cases to the court. So obviously Russians were really, really active in sending their individual complaints to this court. And yet what we noticed was, despite the fact that there's a lot of discrimination against women in Russia in various forms, various spheres, ranging from labor violations to the state's ineffectiveness and police ineffectiveness in dealing with gender-based violence, domestic violence, rape, sexual assault. Despite all of those things, we didn't see cases that were coming up in those court decisions that had to do with gender discrimination.
What kind of cases were taken outside of Russia to this international court?
Besides gender?
Yeah.
A huge range of cases. The vast majority of them in the initial period had to do with basically the ineffectiveness of the Russian state bureaucracy to execute court judgments at the domestic level. So often what would happen was people deserved a pension of some kind from the state, and they had not been receiving it, were unable to obtain it from the state bureaucracy. And so they took the case to domestic court to demand that they get paid their pensions. And the domestic courts actually agreed with them over and over and over again and demanded that the state pension fund pay the pension. But then that would not happen. And it would kind of go through another level, a higher level of Russian court in the domestic level. And then eventually the person would send the case to the European Court of Human Rights. And that court kept issuing repeat decisions about those kinds of cases as well.
Against the government.
And the government would eventually get its act together. And eventually it did kind of mostly resolve the bureaucratic problems that were causing those delays. So that was an effective impact that the
court
ECHR
has no power
had.
But to shame. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Every case demands that if the government is found guilty, the government has to pay compensation. So they get a monetary compensation. But there's not much that can really enforce that. And that's the interesting thing about this court. I mean, in theory, the Council of Europe, it does have a political body called the Committee of Ministers, which is kind of the executive political side of heads of state with their representatives at the Council of Europe. And the Committee of Ministers follows whether or not states are executing the individual judgments and implementing them properly. And that committee can take measures. I mean, it can say things like, we are going to suspend your government from having any representatives in the Parliamentary Assembly, which is kind of the legislature of the Council of Europe, or we will not give you any monetary resources that are coming from this organization. But they're kind of drastic measures, and they haven't been taken very often. It takes a lot for that to happen.
And getting back to women's issues, so of these 40,000 cases that are brought out of Russia, most of are not women, but women have a tremendous problem in Russia.
Yes. So we, in the book, kind of, this was puzzling to us. Why aren't we seeing women taking these cases to court? And we looked at a number of potential areas where you might see these cases coming from. So a trick of the European Convention of Human Rights is that you can only claim the discrimination article, you can only claim a discrimination violation if it's attached to another right that's guaranteed under that convention. And those human rights are limited in that convention. So it includes, for example, the right to life, the right to be free from torture or inhumane treatment. It includes the right to an effective remedy in your court system. And it includes a right to equal rights to education, for example. It doesn't include labor rights. Mm. So we thought, you know, potentially you wouldn't see labor rights cases being sent to that court. As it turns out, Turkish cases have effectively done that. We can get to that later through kind of a trick of argument. But where we did expect to really see it was in areas of violence against women. Because the court had ruled in a few cases, including a groundbreaking Turkish case, that in a case of chronic domestic violence where a woman had been abused again and again and again in a serious way by her partner and had gone to the police in Turkey multiple times and had nothing happen as a response, she was essentially dismissed. Eventually, her husband actually killed her mother, the claimant's mother. And finally, she ended up taking this case to the European Court of Human Rights, and she won. And essentially, the court argued that the state is responsible for this because it did not respond to this woman's repeated complaints. And it's discriminatory because if she had been a man complaining about violence on the street committed against him, especially in a repeated, targeted manner, there would have been action that was taken. So that case was called the Opus versus Turkey case. And we thought lots of these cases are happening in Russia. We've heard again and again in our decades of research that in talking to anti-violence feminist activists, that this is a common reaction of the police. And that commonly in Russian courts, judges will say very sexist things about, well, you provoked it, or you shouldn't be able to leave. Our goal is to keep families together. And we had heard this again and again, so we thought these cases should be ending up at the European Court of Human Rights. But they simply weren't.
And why do you think that was? Why do you think those court cases never made it to the International Court?
Well, one thing we found out fairly quickly was that there aren't that many cases overall at the European Court of Human Rights that find discrimination against women. And people explained that to us in terms of there being a very high evidentiary bar to be able to prove that discrimination has taken place, that something hasn't happened to a victim just as an individual, but it happened to them because they are being badly treated as a representative of a certain social group. And you have to prove that through a very careful statistical data that's showing that this is a pattern that happens again and again. It takes a lot of really qualified lawyers to make that argument. So there haven't been, until recently, very many of these judgments that have been made for any country, including Russia. But in Russia, there are some particular differences we found that distinguish it from other countries like Turkey that have had more of these cases. One of the most interesting things is that the training of lawyers to be able to do this kind of litigation is really important. And strangely, we found that the human rights and women's rights community in Russia is kind of separated, so that the traditional human rights activists, many of whom were dissidents in the Soviet period, fighting for political freedoms of speech, freedom of assembly, and that kind of thing, they do not associate at all with feminist activists or women's rights groups. Those original traditional human rights activists have gotten lots and lots of training from international actors, international experienced litigating organizations, human rights organizations, from the Council of Europe itself. They've gotten lots and lots of training in how to do this, but they've never invited feminist activists to take part in training sessions. So what we found was there's only a very small handful of lawyers who are trained in sex discrimination litigation, or even how to take any kind of a case to the European Court of Human Rights. And so it was very difficult to think of that as an option for a lot of feminist activists. They didn't really think about taking these cases to the court. And when they did think about it, they didn't really know how to act upon it in a credible way.
Well, we're talking with two scholars who will be speaking shortly at the Marshall Center at USF in Tampa, and our guests have just written a book called Courting Gender Justice, Russia, Turkey, and the European Court of Human Rights. Our guests are Lisa Sundstrom, who we've been hearing from, and Valerie Sperling. Lisa, you teach in Vancouver, Canada.
Yes, I teach at the University of British Columbia.
Great. And also here is Valerie Sperling, who teaches at Clark University in Worcester, Mass.
That's right.
All right. It's great to have you here. Both of you are experts on Russia. You've been to Russia. I want to ask you this is too hard to get an answer in 30 seconds, but the human rights situation in Russia, I mean, if women don't feel comfortable bringing these cases and aren't getting justice in Russia, what is the human rights situation overall in Russia today?
Well, I think it's certainly a challenging situation. As you know, over the last 20 years or so, there's been a gradual decline in democratization, and really, I think we would say a reversal of democratization, and the country has really reverted to being an authoritarian regime, albeit with the trappings of an electoral democracy. So there's more than one party, there are opposition politicians, but the outcomes of the elections are more or less foreordained, and it's not a level playing field. So all the different parties don't have the same access to television and to radio and even to being able to hold a rally.
Since Putin came to power, has there been a fair election, a free election in Russia?
I would say that the elections have gone downhill in terms of their fairness. So if you look in the first decade of the 21st century, the elections are, objectively speaking, more competitive. They're more pluralist. And then over time, we've seen the pro-government party, United Russia, Putin's party, gain a larger percentage of the seats in the legislature. Now, that said, in 2011, 2012, there was a legislative election in December of 2011, and there was quite a lot of protest, you know, hundreds of thousands of people coming out into the street to protest because the election results were so blatantly falsified. People had done monitoring of the elections inside of the polling stations, where they literally videotaped people taking stacks of ballots, marking them for United Russia, and putting them into the ballot box. And then they uploaded those videos to the web. They went viral, and people went out in the streets.
That's our guest, Valerie Sperling. She's written a couple of very interesting books, called Sex, Politics, and Putin, and the brand new one that she wrote with Robert Boatwright, Trumping Politics as Usual. Valerie, you were on the air a few years ago when Sex, Politics, and Putin came out, and I wonder if you could just go back for us for a moment. And the theme of the book is, would it be fair to say that it was how President Putin used sex and hyper-masculinity to gain power in Russia? Would that be a fair summation?
That's certainly part of it. So what I was interested in looking at that book was, how do we use masculinity and femininity and homophobia in politics as a tool that helps us gain political legitimacy or undermine the political legitimacy of the people on the other team? And so when you think of Putin, you know, you think of the guy, you know, the bare-chested guy on the horse, or, you know, fishing with his shirt off. And, you know, so masculinity was very important to Putin's political legitimacy. And this was something probably that resulted from his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, who over the course of the 1990s went from being this highly respected, you know, much lauded Democrat, and I would say also kind of a tough guy, to becoming infirm and an alcoholic and weak, and seeing Russia itself go from being the Soviet superpower to becoming this kind of third-rate power compared to what it had been before. So when Yeltsin resigned and Putin became the acting president and then was elected president, an important aspect of his legitimacy was about lifting Russia up and kind of, as Putin had said, bringing Russia up off its knees. And so his masculinity was kind of the way to pull Russia out of this state of weakness and get it back onto the world stage in a position of strength, which is one of the reasons why Putin is so, to this day, extremely popular, because it is seen that under his rule, Russia got back to the center of international relations, which made people feel good compared to kind of the weakened, enfeebled Russia of the 90s.
Can you give us an example of how Putin used, in an election, used sex or sexual imagery beyond the pictures of him on horseback, bare-chested, but what other techniques did he use in elections to prove his masculinity?
Yeah, it's a good question. So some of this doesn't come from Putin himself, right? Some of this comes from organized groups in society. And one of the things that I was interested in that book in particular was how young people were showing their support for Putin. And in fact, what got me interested in writing the book was this group of journalists, women journalists at Moscow State University, which is like the best university in Russia. This group of 12 or 13 young women made a calendar for Putin's birthday. And on this calendar, it was like a pinup calendar. They were wearing sort of Victoria's Secret type clothing, and each one was featured on a separate page for the different months. And each one of them had like a speech bubble, coming out of her mouth saying something. And so one of them said, how about a third time, which implied, because he had already been president twice, and they were suggesting that he should run for, a third term. And then somebody else said, you put the fires out, but I'm still burning. And this was because there had been these fires outside of Moscow during the summer, and Putin had gotten in a firefighting helicopter and helped to quench the fires. So I was interested in that because that would be as though, a dozen students at the Columbia School of Journalism in the United States had, taken off most of their clothes and made, a calendar for the president. It was sort of unusual anyway. So to me, it became an interesting example about how femininity and masculinity enter into politics, because this is a way of showing that very attractive young women were on Putin's team. So what does that do? That legitimizes him as a man. So it's not just, so masculinity isn't just about kind of bravery and, showing off your own muscles. It's also about getting proof of your virility, heterosexuality, desirability. So that's an example.
So in your new book, which is called Trumping Politics as Usual, that you co-wrote with Robert Boatwright, you focus on American elections. Did American politicians learn anything from Putin and his use of hypermasculinity?
So that's interesting, right? I don't think that we can credit Putin with this just because it's a very old story. Once you start putting on, I guess I would say, gender lenses and looking at politics, you can look as far back as you want and you'll see examples of masculinity in competitive politics. Politics and even in authoritarian politics, actually, but so I don't know that I would say that this came from Putin, but there are certainly echoes of machismo that you can see. In fact, if you think back to the Republican primary in 2016 in the presidential election, there was an enormously graphic masculinity contest that was going on there, with Trump calling Marco Rubio, little Marco, trying to imply that he wasn't a real man, he was just a little boy. And then Marco Rubio turned around and tried to suggest that Trump's genitalia were undersized by referring to Trump's small hands, and then Jeb Bush tried to save his dying campaign, which was dying in part because Trump was calling Jeb Bush low energy Jeb, again, that sort of jab at, potency and virility. And Jeb Bush tweeted out an image of a handgun with his name engraved on it, titled America, trying to show that, in fact, he was masculine. And then you get, Trump calling Ted Cruz a pussy because he refused to endorse waterboarding. I mean, there was an enormous masculinity contest. And you can see it. It's funny. You raised Putin in this context. After Trump became president, there was an international masculinity contest that took place around handshaking. And there was all this, Trump yanking people off of balance and then I think it was Macron, who said that he had kind of studied the handshake in advance, and they ended up with this, 25-second handshake.
Oh, this is where Trump is hanging on inordinately
exactly.
Long to other people's hands in order to prove that he was dominant.
Yes, and sometimes kind of moving them off balance. And then there was all this speculation when Trump met Putin, what would the handshake be like? You know, so
who won that contest?
I think that was a draw. Yeah, so lest you wonder if masculinity plays an important role in politics, you'll see that it does.
In a few minutes, or in about a half an hour or so, I guess it's an hour, you'll be speaking at the Marshall Center in room 3707 about your first topic, courting gender justice, Russia, Turkey, and the European Court of Human Rights. We're also interested, though, in Putin and whether or not he has designs on the American election next year. You're Russian experts. That's not exactly your field, but can I ask you that question? What do you think about Putin's designs on getting involved some other way, more than he did during the last presidential election? What's your take on that?
You know, I think that it's fair to expect that there will be, and that there has continued to be, interference, right, in our political system. And from, you know, and from Russia's perspective, it's absolutely the right thing to do, because even if you don't end up with your desired candidate, or you end up with your desired candidate by accident, what that kind of interference does is it undermines the idea of democracy, and it enables authoritarian leaders like Putin to say, you know, that's what you want. You want this kind of chaotic, uncontrolled system where they can't, you know, they have to take up all their time with impeachment and argument. You know, that's not a good system. So I think that that's really the underlying goal of the intervention, is to try to delegitimize democracy as a political system.
Lisa, would you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely agree with that. And I would also say we are getting signs from all kinds of experts all over the place that this is happening. The efforts are there. And I think the efforts are also, I wouldn't expect to see outright kind of infiltration or undermining of the election balloting system itself. I don't expect that, but I do expect even more sophisticated use of fake news, kind of manipulating people's social media feeds so that people just get confused and they don't know what the truth is anymore, and they kind of give up and perhaps just go with their gut or go with their siloed information on one side or the other.
With confusion and dissension being the goal.
With confusion and dissension being the goal, and just showing, look, America is a mess. We are strong. We are organized. Democracy is not all it's cracked up to be.
Well, it's always great to get Russian scholars on the show. Thank you for coming by, Lisa Sundstrom. Lisa, do you have a website?
Yeah. I don't have a very sophisticated website, but if you go to the UBC Political Science Department, just Google my name, you will come up with my page, and you can find all my info there and my Twitter feed and so on.
Great. Lisa Sundstrom from the University of British Columbia and Val Sperling from Clark University.
Thank you very much for having us.
Do you have a website?
Same as what Lisa said, actually. Okay. Go to Clark University and you'll find me.
All right. Well, Valerie and Lisa, thank you very much. They'll both be speaking today at the Marshall Center on the USF Tampa campus at 12:30. And this is free and open to the public. They'll be speaking in Marshall Center room 3707. I could have spoken for hours with you because we just opened the door to the topics of sexism and gender inequality and Russian human rights. So please come back.
Thank you so much, Rob.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. In a moment, we'll listen back to what Alan Dershowitz said last night from the floor of the Senate.
Zuma, Zuma, Arjonge, Matare, Ngoro, Mera. Anna notion. I've never seen it. Zuma ne zuma, aji tonge matare jibakera. I've never seen it. I've never seen it. Zuma ne zuma, aji tonge matare kona munde. I've never seen it. I've never seen it.
Music from Oliver Mitakudzi, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phone lines during the last part of today's program and take your comments and calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're going to play, first of all, moment in yesterday's question and answer session in the Senate in the impeachment trial of President Trump that I think has gotten the most attention, and that is where Alan Dershowitz made a defense of the president and essentially saying that the president could do virtually anything, including engaging in a quid pro quo for purely political benefit, as long as it's in the service of winning re-election. Let's listen to what the Harvard law professor said yesterday. And we'll hear the question that was directed to him, and then we're going to get your take on this. Our phone number, 813-239-9663, and this is 88.5 FM.
The question is addressed to counsel for the president. As a matter of law, does it matter if there was a quid pro quo? Is it true that quid pro quos are often used in foreign policy?
Chief Justice, thank you very much for your question. Yesterday, I had the privilege of attending the rolling out of a peace plan by the President of the United States regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I offered you a hypothetical the other day. What if a Democratic president were to be elected and Congress were to authorize much money to either Israel or the Palestinians, and the Democratic president were to say to Israel, "No, I'm going to withhold this money unless you stop all settlement growth," or to the Palestinians, "I will withhold the money Congress authorized to you unless you stop paying terrorists." And the president said, "Quid pro quo. If you don't do it, you don't get the money. If you do it, you get the money." There's no one in this chamber that would regard that as in any way unlawful. The only thing that would make a quid pro quo unlawful is if the quo were in some way illegal. Now, we talked about motive. There are three possible motives that a political figure can have. One, a motive in the public interest, and the Israel argument would be in the public interest. The second is in his own political interest. And the third, which hasn't been mentioned, would be in his own financial interest, his own pure financial interest, just putting money in the bank. I want to focus on the second one for just one moment. Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment. I quoted President Lincoln. When President Lincoln told General Sherman to let the troops go to Indiana so that they can vote for the Republican Party, let's assume the president was running at that point, and it was in his electoral interest to have these soldiers put at risk the lives of many, many other soldiers who would be left without their company, would that be an unlawful quid pro quo? No, because the president, A, believed it was in the national interest, but B, he believed that his own election was essential to victory in the Civil War. Every president believes that. That's why it's so dangerous to try to psychoanalyze a president, to try to get into the intricacies of the human mind. Everybody has mixed motives. And for there to be a constitutional impeachment based on mixed motives would permit almost any president to be impeached. How many presidents have made foreign policy decisions after checking with their political advisors and their pollsters? If you're just acting in the national interest, what do you need pollsters? What do you need political advisors? Just do what's best for the country. But if you want to balance what's in the public interest with what's in your party's electoral interest and your own electoral interest, it's impossible to discern how much weight is given to one to the other. Now, we may argue that it's not in the national interest for a particular president to get reelected or for a particular senator or member of Congress. And maybe we're right. It's not in the national interest for everybody who's running to be elected. But for it to be impeachable, you would have to discern that he or she made a decision solely on the basis of, as the House managers put it, corrupt motives. And it cannot be a corrupt motive if you have a mixed motive that partially involves the national interest, partially involves electoral, and does not involve personal pecuniary interests. And the House managers do not allege that this decision, this quid pro quo, as they call it, and the question is based on the hypothesis there was a quid pro quo, I'm not acting the facts, they never allege that it was based on pure financial reasons. It would be a much harder case if a hypothetical president of the United States said to a hypothetical leader of a foreign country, unless you build a hotel with my name on it, and unless you give me $1 million kickback, I will withhold the funds. That's an easy case. That's purely corrupt and in the purely private interest. But a complex middle case is, I want to be elected. I think I'm a great president. I think I'm the greatest president there ever was. And if I'm not elected, the national interest will suffer greatly. Thank you. That cannot be an impeachable offense. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Alan Dershowitz yesterday, the president's attorney and former Harvard law professor, taking the view that presidential power is pretty wide. He said that the president could do virtually anything, including engaging in a quid pro quo for a purely political benefit, as long as it's in the service of winning re-election. He is a subscriber to the so-called unitary executive theory, the idea that the president's power is all but absolute and rarely subject to congressional oversight or investigation. What do you think about that? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go back and listen to a little bit of what President Nixon, after he was out of office, after he resigned from office, told David Frost in an interview in 1974 about the extent of presidential power. Here is impeached President Richard Nixon.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal, by definition.
Exactly.
When the president does it, that means it is not illegal by definition, Richard Nixon. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. We'll take some phone calls and emails about this, and let's go to Cindy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Cindy. You're on WMNF. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think Dershowitz is full of crap. I don't believe a thing he said yesterday. I think it's dangerous what he said, and I think we should be looking to the Constitution for the facts and the truth. Apparently, we're not going to get it in this trial. Dershowitz is the same guy who was patting Pompeo on the back in that Israeli meeting they had yesterday when Trump was congratulating Pompeo about yelling at one of our journalists. These are the kinds of men that are trying their hardest to dismantle what the founders sacrificed so much to have for us. These are the men who are trying to bring us down. I don't believe a thing that Dershowitz says or any of Trump's counselors. And it's a shame. It's a tragedy. It's a travesty. And I know that he'll probably get acquitted, but I certainly hope that the American public is listening to what's happening. This is extremely important. And voices their opinion at the ballot box. Thank you.
All right, Cindy, thanks a lot. Thanks for being the first one today, too. Thank you. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. Let's take some more phone calls. I want to just get your take on what Dershowitz said yesterday. Cindy said that the Constitution would prohibit this, but there are some people that say that Article 2 of the Constitution would give any president unlimited authority. That is a view that is held by our Attorney General, William Barr, and some other members of the Federalist Society. But what do you think about that? Here's one of the key moments from what Dershowitz said yesterday. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663.
Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
Now, is that your definition of public interest? Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Dave in Valrico. Hey, Dave, you're on MNF. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for taking the call. I don't have a lot to say, but if I go along with Dershowitz's thinking, I believe it's in the public interest to assassinate Trump. Now, isn't that ridiculous? That makes it okay? It's just stupid reasoning on his side.
I think Dershowitz's definition of public interest is not really an accurate definition of what the public interest is. The public interest is not decided, I think, by one person. The public interest is decided by general consensus based on the benefit to the most number of people. But it's not in the public interest to have one man reelected because he wants to be reelected, I would say.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
Dershowitz is nuts.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot. I'm sure there are people that support Dershowitz, and we'd like to hear from some people that do believe in the unitary executive theory that the president has essentially unlimited power. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Fran in Largo. Hey, Fran, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Thank you, Rob. I hope I can word this right, but I keep thinking when this whole impeachment thing started, wasn't there one official, maybe it was that Ambassador Sondland, I'm not sure whether it was him or not, that said that Trump wanted to know about the big stuff, meaning this investigation into corruption in Ukraine. And it was said, whoever said it, Sondland or whoever said, and by the big stuff, he didn't mean anything but the investigation of Biden. I mean, that to me makes this whole thing crystal clear. I'm not Alan Dershowitz that can twist things around and get people off, even if they don't deserve it. Personally, that's what gives lawyers such a bad reputation. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. I hope I got it right.
All right, Fran, I think you're right. I think it was the ambassador that said that. Fran, thanks a lot. All right, and if somebody wants to correct me, I'll read the correction on the air, too. But I'm pretty sure that Fran is right. Let's go to Teresa in St. Petersburg. Hi, Teresa. What do you think?
Well, I would like to know what Constitution Alan Dershowitz is reading. I mean, our president doesn't have the right to just do whatever he wants. Otherwise, Obama would have done it and got away with it, and Bush and all the other ones would have had a dictator, right? I mean,
That's the question. I mean, Dershowitz, I think, wants us to believe that the president is above the law if he chooses to be above the law. And I have a hard time thinking that that's what the founders wanted.
Well, no, I don't think so at all, because they never thought they were above the law. I don't know. I wasn't around then. But that's, you know, I hate to always do the what if, but if Hillary were president and she did the exact same thing, they would impeach her, remove her from office, as she should be, and if any other president did this, because it's one thing to to ask the American citizens to vote for you. Say, hey, you're better off voting for me than this guy. That's fine. But you don't ask a foreign government to interfere so that you can be, that's going to benefit you.
Well, Teresa, I think that's a perfect exercise. I think that's what they would do in law school, too. If the shoe were on the other foot, would you okay it? So let's ask that question. If Hillary Clinton had asked for help from a foreign government to investigate a political rival or to at least announce an investigation of a political rival, would that be okay?
No, it wouldn't be, and I would say impeach her and remove her from office, and I voted for her. But I'm a Democrat that believes country first, party second. I mean, that's just me. I don't know how many people are like that anymore, but that's me. And what if Iran decides, wow, we got to get rid of Trump, so we're going to help whatever Democrat gets the nomination. Is that going to be okay with all these Trump supporters? Sure, go ahead. Who cares? It ain't okay with me.
Okay, let's take some more phone calls. Teresa, thanks a lot. Thanks for checking in. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, what do you think?
Oh, Rob, I agree with all your callers this morning. I think Dershowitz is off his rocker lately, and has been for a while. With this, I guess we owe Richard Nixon an apology. Richard Nixon should have never been impeached. I guess, it was in his interest to go ahead and break in and, let these people break into the Watergate, into the building there. So, and Neil Cajal, who my sister bought that book for me for Christmas, which I have to delve into, and he was great this morning on Democracy Now!, and he was saying that it's just totally ridiculous. I got a feeling that Dershowitz is bought off. I think he's just been bought. I don't see why, because I would imagine he has a whole lot of money, but I don't know. I just have this feeling that he's been bought off.
Danny, do you think it makes any difference that he was one of Jeffrey Epstein's attorneys? And was implicated in some alleged inappropriate activity?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Maybe, perhaps. I just don't understand. This guy, I agree with Daryl. I think he should give money back to some of the people who went to his law school because, as a professor, I don't understand. I don't understand what he's saying. He got blown away, if you remember, in the 2002 debate with Martin Finkelstein. Martin Finkelstein just left smoke and feathers in his face, just blew him completely away. I have a question for you that's real quick on this coronavirus. They're bringing back all the no more flights over here. There's no more flights scheduled over there. No Americans. They canceled all the flights to China. There are some people saying that they ought to do the same from China to here. What is your opinion about that?
To cancel all flights from China to here?
Yeah. Since they're doing that, since they're doing that over here, they've canceled all flights to China. And because of the coronavirus, that they're saying that they should do the same. And they say that they're thinking about doing that.
Yeah, I'm not a health expert. I would say that I would defer to health experts on that. And right now, as we speak, there's a cruise ship with 7,000 people on board.
I saw that.
And they're being confined to the cruise ship. They're not being let off. Because somebody has the coronavirus on board. So this is in Italy.
Listen, I want to take you back real quick to 2014 and 2015 when you're always excellent, but you were like on fire. And I don't know if you remember when Calvina Fay and Elaine Chao hung up on you.
Well,
you remember that?
I don't know if Elaine Chao hung up on me, but yeah, we had a woman who was anti-legalization of marijuana who hung up on me, yes.
Yeah, that was Calvina Fay.
You've got a great memory, Danny.
Thank you, Rob.
Okay, thanks, Danny. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. I think the question I asked at that time, not that it's relevant to this show, but I asked, had anybody died from overdosing on marijuana? Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Here's some emails that have come in, and I'll read a few before we go back to the phones. This person says, Dershowitz is ridiculous. And then the person goes on to say, his argument has nothing to do with national interest. It has much to do with Trump's damaged ego. This ain't the dream team. It's the ream team. Trump is reaming America, writes Bubba. And then Ahmad writes, if during the Cold War any president would have acted in the way that this one has, he would have certainly have been hanged for treason. It seems that the Republicans would be happy to let Putin decide the election, writes Ahmad. That's Ahmad's opinion. And what's your opinion? You know, I think what Teresa asked was a good one. And that is, if Hillary Clinton had reached out to another country and asked that country to hold a press conference or make an announcement on CNN that her Republican political rival was being investigated for corruption in that country, what would your response be as a Republican? What do you think? 813-239-9663. Would you want Hillary Clinton to be removed from office? Let's go back to the phones, and we're going to go to Ted, who's at Bay Pines. Hi, Ted. You're on M&F.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
So take it away, Ted.
Well, I realize I'm calling a liberal radio station, but I'm a very pro-Trump guy, and I'm still having trouble seeing what he has done wrong, especially in consideration of what the Clintons did wrong with the FISA and the Steele thing, what Biden did wrong about having the guy fired, et cetera, et cetera. All those things seem to be okay, and Trump did nothing really that bad. And I'm just at a loss of why people are so up. The Trump hater syndrome, I guess.
Well, let's see. I mean, we're a radio station that does believe in peace and social justice and equality. If you call that liberal, I imagine those are values that you also support.
But I do realize that you kind of chuckle at the liberal comments against Trump, but that's okay, old Dershowitz.
Well, I played the president's defender yesterday, Alan Dershowitz, making.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. So that's what I was asking about. But you think the president has done nothing wrong. Let me ask our listeners to maybe answer that question for you, okay?
Oh, I'm sure what I'll be hearing.
Okay, Ted, hang in there. Thank you, Ted. Good to hear from you.
Always.
Thank you. 813-239-9663. And let's go to Don in Largo. Hey, Don, you're on M&F.
The third thing that Alan Dershowitz mentioned was acting in his own financial interests. During the 2016, he was trying to negotiate a deal with Russia to make some kind of money from some kind of project he wanted to establish in Russia. Ukraine was at war with Russia. Russia seizes Ukraine territory, its military aid. And he won't give military aid to a country that's at war with someone who's pretty much always been viewed as an adversary to the United States. And then, of course, Turkey was allowed to invade Syria, and Trump has hotels and so forth in Istanbul. And Saudi Arabia was allowed to torture and murder that American journalist.
Yeah, you know, but I think all that is true, but I think the defense against that is that those are not part of the articles of impeachment that the House has brought over to the Senate. So I think that's what
it is part of the Constitution, that you shouldn't take payments from foreign governments, and he does, and so did Hillary. And it's based on the premise that just people described in the Constitution don't exist. You have to have a lot of money, take bribes, and be incorporated. It's totally upside down, wrong, and backwards. It led us to two constitutionally disqualified candidates in the 2016 election.
All right, Don, thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, I think had the Democrats brought up those issues or proved that there was some malfeasance there and brought them up as articles of impeachment, you might be on a little bit more solid ground. I understand your frustration at these issues you think haven't been really discussed enough. But let's go to Kevin. We had our caller, Ted, who said he didn't understand what President Trump has done wrong. Kevin, you're on M&F. What would you like to say?
Yes, sir. I would like to take umbrage with the gentleman that was on just a moment ago, saying that he thought that the assassination of the president would be appropriate. And you had
Well, I don't think you heard. You didn't hear his whole thing. He said, would that be appropriate? And then he said, no, it would not be appropriate. So that's how.
I think that anything on that line is way out of bounds.
Well, he corrected himself right away, though. He wasn't suggesting that the president
did. I listened to it, and I don't believe he did.
Well, Kevin, I think you were listening to for what you wanted to hear. Nobody is suggesting that the president should be assassinated, and that caller corrected himself.
Appropriate.
He said, would it be appropriate? Then he said, no, it would not. And Kevin, if you're trying to make the case, that somehow we would support that, you're wrong, and we have the tapes, so we can prove that you're wrong. Okay.
We can prove you're wrong. Well, then stop speaking for a moment. I think that the president has done the greatest things for the humanity of the United States in the past 3 years, and that the Democrats would not like to, admit that he has done so many things that are for the good of the president, for the good of the country.
Okay. All right. And Kevin, thanks a lot. We're out of time. Thank you very much. And if you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks a lot for listening. And in the next hour, the Tampa City Council person who's in the middle of a controversy over what he said about Jewish people, we're going to hear that discussion.